Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and we've got a slightly different edition of the show for this week. Alex Stamos is filling in for Adam Boileau. In the news slot, most of you know him as Facebook's recently departed chief security officer. Alex also served as the CISO at Yahoo for a time, but his security career stretches back quite a long way. He co-founded iSec Partners back in 2004, and before that, he did some time with AtStake. The AtStake mafia is everywhere. It's really quite amazing. These days, Alex is an adjunct professor at Stanford University, and he'll be joining me shortly to talk through the week's security news, as well as to have a chat about the Edward Snowden disclosures 5 years on. This week's show is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. Big thanks to them for that. And instead of one of their staff being on the show this week in the sponsor chair, they asked me to interview this week's sponsor guest, their customer, Mike Ruth, who is a security engineer with Cruise Automation. Mike did a presentation at a conference called QCon recently, all about automating the deployment of Canary tokens at scale using some nifty CI/CD tricks. He'll be joining us after the news to tell us all about that. But before all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's security news with a good friend of the show, Mr. Alex Stamos. And Alex, Israeli surveillance software company NSO Group has been in the news for all of the wrong reasons over the last few days. They're looking pretty bad right now.
Yeah, some negative headlines for NSO, and I think it's really going to have some impact on Israel overall. I've actually talked to some folks there, and I think the fact that Israel allows these companies to sell weapons to these not great countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE is really going to rebound on their cybersecurity industry overall.
Let's just take a step back for a moment and just talk about what's actually happened, because we've got a few things to get through here. First up, it turns out that NSO Group sold $55 million worth of kit, to Saudi Arabia just before the purges started. I mean, that's a really bad look, especially for an Israeli company.
Yeah, it is amazing. It is amazing what kind of bedfellows you create when it comes to building malware to go after journalists and enemies of the state. Does not look good. It interesting to see what the price list too. $55 million. That's a pretty good deal for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of you're presuming that's the full package, right? The platinum deal.
Yeah, but now they have no control over what happens. Like, once it's out of your hands and it's in the hands of the Saudis, you know, they're really going to get themselves tied up into issues that I think they never expected that they would be pulled into publicly.
Well, I think they kind of should have expected that, right? And of course, you know, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has been going after enemies pretty hard. We've seen, you know, even a journalist, very public case, Khashoggi or Khashoggi, depending on who you are, who's saying it. But it turns out some of this NSO Group stuff was deployed against some of his close associates. So it seems through work by Citizen Lab and other organizations, I mean, it seems pretty obvious that this stuff wasn't being used to target people who posed, a real security threat, right?
Yeah, there's always this goal of both NSO Group and their customers to say that this is the equivalent of like the FBI deploying what they call a network investigative tool. But these are not child pornographers. These are not terrorists that they're hacking. These are journalists and dissidents. And it raises a really interesting question, which is, where is Khashoggi's phone now? We haven't seen any forensic evidence directly from his devices to see if he was a target of the Saudis, and specifically if he was targeted by any NSO Group malware.
You'd have to imagine that, you know, whether or not he was infected, he was at least a target given what happened to him. But yeah, I mean, the crazy thing is, you know, a state like Saudi Arabia actually does have some pretty legitimate threats, but until they lift their game, like, it's my personal belief, like, nobody should be selling this stuff to them. I mean, are you happy to call it as black and white as that as well?
I think so. Although, as an American, that's a tough thing to say, since we are selling them actual physical weapons that are being used in a war in Yemen to hurt civilians in a horrible way. So while I do think NSO Group is wrong, it is hard as an American to cast a lot of aspersions on Israel in this matter.
It's funny you mentioned that came up in, you know, I drew a similar parallel in a conversation recently at KiwiCon, which is, you know, are we heading to that world where, you know, say there are interception capabilities built into consumer grade products and governments are actually deciding, you know, where they go, will that be decided on human rights grounds or is it going to be much like military technology? And I suspect it's the latter, which is sad news, but sad news as old as government itself. Now, it's not just drama involving Saudi Arabians that NSO Group has been ensnared in. A couple of Mexican journalists had, there were clear attempts to drop Pegasus, NSO's malware, onto the phones of a couple of Mexican journalists after the assassination of one of their colleagues. Now, you might think, oh, okay, well, maybe that's the government just wants to investigate this murder, but more likely the government may have in fact been involved. So, other people in the media receiving phishing links, understandably a little bit twitchy.
Yeah. And, Mexico seems to be part of this class of countries that have aggressive intelligence services that do not have their own R&D capabilities at the level that they want. And so they're buying off the shelf. But the flip side is countries in that category are probably likely to use these capabilities in ways that have not been really democratically vetted. So if you're going to be in this space, your best customers are probably the ones that are going to get you in the most trouble.
I do really wonder. It feels like this is coming back as a topic again in a pretty big way. The last time we saw big rounds of coverage on this was the Hacking Team breach and, prior to that, I guess, the FinFisher stuff. Does it feel to you like there's enough hitting the press at the moment for this to get a bit of critical mass and traction again?
I think the key thing is to see if there's going to be a direct link to the Khashoggi murder. If you can tie NSO Group directly to the murder of a journalist who was living in the United States, that is going to hit it big time. And that is going to jump off of this podcast onto CNN and Fox News. And I think that's a change we might need if we ever want to have any kind of international regulation of these kinds of weapons being sold to these countries.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because Edward Snowden was speaking at an event recently and drew that link, which I think is not such an unreasonable one, to be honest. I mean, half the time when he does appearances, he can say some pretty silly things, but that is not one of them.
I think that link definitely can happen. I did not see him actually cite any evidence, and I'm not sure from his apartment in Moscow exactly what evidence he might have available to him, but it is definitely a possibility that we could see some hard evidence to come out that NSO was part of the kill chain, in this case, unfortunately, a literal kill chain that ended in the death of a journalist.
Moving closer to home, my home at least, the Home Affairs Department here in Australia has tried to hose down concerns that, funnily enough, first bubbled up on this podcast, that its proposed assistance and access bill will damage the export of Australian security technology.
Yeah, this is interesting. There's a lot of parsing by your government there in Australia of what assistance means. And I think what's going on is that they're trying to play this as different things to different people, that when they say technical assistance, they're trying to disclaim that that's actually going to affect encryption. But in the long run, for the information that these governments want, not just the Australians, but really every major government, technical assistance at some point is going to mean dropping security protections. So I don't know if this is the camel's nose under the tent or if this is their final state. But it does seem that they're putting a lot of play on the exact word assistance and what it means.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I can tell right now, the bill is actually a bit of a mess. One of the problems is they've got this whole thing about how they can't compel anyone to introduce a systemic weakness, but under the current bill, as far as I understand it, it's the Attorney General who decides what is and what is not a systemic weakness, which is probably not ideal.
Does this Attorney General believe the law of maths does not apply in Australia?
Oh, that was the Prime Minister. But at the time, it was the Prime Minister that week. But we had another Attorney General who couldn't explain metadata. That was pretty funny. They're not the best at explaining this stuff. But look, I do have some information here, some case studies, really, or some use cases, I should say, that have been sent to me by a senior government official seeking to try to explain what they're seeking to do, right? Like really what they're seeking to do, which maybe isn't reflected as well in the bill as it should be. But here's one scenario. Two criminals communicating via a secure messaging app. As the communication is started, they would like to be inserted into that chat, which, I think that's you kind of dreaming there. But a lot of the other scenarios that they pass to me actually involve there's two things that they seem to revolve around. One of them is compelling ISPs or technology makers to block certain users from receiving security updates. I found that one pretty interesting, right? So if you can block a security update to a specific user, then they could reverse engineer a patch and get access that way. And the other example was, this source says that, look, you know, all of these tech companies have advanced knowledge of security vulnerabilities in their products. They would like these companies to maybe use those vulnerabilities to gain access on behalf of the government to these devices under warrant. I mean, I think if it was limited to that sort of thing, it starts to look reasonable. The problem is the bill doesn't sort of reflect that, right?
Yeah, the holding back patches, I'm not sure that the lawmakers understand that generally that responsibility on the mobile devices is the responsibility of Google and Apple in most cases, and in some cases, you know, various phone manufacturers who have their own app stores. That's a pretty dangerous capability, right? Like, you're definitely asking them, you know, to have a blacklist of these individual phones can't get updates for these apps. That's an interesting thing to ask them to build, and something I think could be abused a lot. So it'd be interesting to see if that would be qualify as a systemic vulnerability or not in the system.
One thing I'd like to see is that systemic vulnerability test move to the court away from the Attorney General. But I wonder if, you know, you could probably do that at a telco level though.
Yeah, I don't think so. Like, I think if you're looking from the telco perspective, you know, you have this encrypted connection between the operating system and the service and the CDN that belongs to the phone manufacturer. I'm not sure that you're going to be able to do that kind of filtering on a per app level. I think that generally will be pretty difficult. So it's a kind of a weird little flip of, you know, a lot of people were talking about asking for specific backdoors to be inserted in updates for individuals. The flip side of blocking updates for individuals is an interesting play, but the companies that could do that, Google or Apple, for them to build that capability for Australia, would that capability be asked to be used all over the world in a way that I think even the Australians would find unpalatable?
Yeah. Well, it's getting interesting, isn't it? Like, at least the conversation is advancing a little.
It is. And it will be interesting to see if this is really just Australia acting on its own, or if this is an intentional push by the Five Eyes to use Australia as a testbed for a number of ideas to see which float by the Australian populace without too much objection. And then if we see similar bills in the UK and Canada.
Well, I mean, pretty much everything goes past without much objection in Australia, to be honest. We're a pretty laid back bunch. There was some, you know, I mean, there was the five country ministerial statement that appeared to be a, you know, synchronization of policy attitudes towards this sort of thing. We saw that a couple of months back. Although I will say that, you know, I did ask when this first came up, I asked someone, you know, close to government, whether or not this was part of some sort of synchronized policy push with the United States. And they basically said that since Trump was elected, all cooperation on stuff like this basically stopped, right? Like, no one works at the State Department anymore.
Right. No one works at the State Department. There's no cybersecurity coordinator in the NSC. I know there's people in the DOJ who continue to think about these issues. And, you know, I don't think coordination is necessarily a bad thing. It would not be bad for a number of Western democracies to say, this is the information that we demand under these kinds of legal controls. I think that would actually set a good precedent. Where it gets a little more worrying is when the precedent they set is that you have to actually water down the protections that are currently in place.
Moving on to some bread and butter infosec here. And we've seen, look, you know, it is the year of the supply chain attack. We've seen one here that is both high impact and hilarious. Please tell us about it, Alex.
Yeah, so it looks like our Bitcoin stealing friends have attacked the supply chain for NPM. The node package manager by inserting a backdoor that allowed them to steal private keys on affected wallets. This is one interesting that finally it is the year of the Linux desktop, I guess, to the point of where people are doing
to the point where something like this matters, right?
Like, where something like this could actually matter. I think you're totally right to talk about the supply chain. You know, as everybody has been focused on hardware supply chain attacks, which are obviously much harder to pull off, this kind of software attack is something we're going to see more and more of. And it also reinforces a point that I've tried to make with other folks, which is Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies overall has completely revolutionized the economics of hacking, that you can now pull off attacks that it makes sense to spend months and months and months weaving your way into the supply chain, because in the end you will possibly walk away with millions of dollars that you no longer have to launder out of the banking system.
Well, it might be hundreds of thousands of dollars now.
Right. Well, they're definitely,
given recent events.
Yes, there definitely is a risk to these hackers who have spent months or years getting ready for this point of currency fluctuations. But you know, but eventually,
I mean, the thing that I find really fascinating about this story is just how the attacker got themselves into a position to do this, which is they just approached the maintainer and said, "Hey, how'd you like me to maintain this chunk of code?" And you know, the person who was the maintainer said, "Sure, here you go. Here's commit rights."
Yeah, and it's just amazing to me that like a huge chunk of our economy is now based upon common open source libraries, for which the responsibility for that is something that is just doled out between friends and completely and totally you know, based upon who you meet on Slack or who you meet on IRC. And you know, the other thing that this looks like is the Chrome issue, right? That like you have these Chrome extensions that are incredibly powerful that are deployed on hundreds of thousands, if not millions of machines. And it's just being maintained by one or two guys who are open to somebody saying, "Hey, can I be a maintainer or can I buy your company from you?
Yeah, I'll give you some Dogecoin, right? Like, let's just buy that extension. It's got a good install base. We believe in the future. We're creating a company, whatever, right?"
Yeah, we're all, you know, everybody uses open source. All of the big companies love to use these open source packages. It turns out it's not free, right? Like when you're using something that is maintained by some guy in his dorm room, the supply chain attacks become a real thing you got to think about.
Well, it's funny, you know, I mean, I do these all of these sort of sponsored interviews to you know, that's really the paying part of my job. And I did one recently for an upcoming snake oiler slot with a company called White Source Software. And, you know, this is an emerging market. There's other companies that do similar stuff like Snyk. I think even Veracode might have something in this space, although I don't think it's as comprehensive. But, you know, their whole company is about software composition analysis to address this problem, right? So they're scanning enterprise repos, looking for open source libraries, they're cataloging them, they're alerting on bugs and goings on. They've even got browser plugins for developers that alert them when they're browsing a repo for something that contains vulnerabilities, like, which I think is a hilarious example of shifting left all the way off the page. But you know, you can see why companies like that are getting big raises at the moment, because this is a real problem. You cannot keep track of the components in your enterprise apps with spreadsheets anymore. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, you definitely need to have some kind of product that is telling you what all the streams of water that's being mixed up in that eventual river of code that's flowing through your company. But that's not going to detect something like that, right? That is useful from a forensics perspective, that once you know that something like event stream has been backdoored, that you can very quickly look to see what kind of vulnerabilities, you know, what kind of exposure you have to that vulnerability. But
until someone flags the vulnerability, you don't know anything, right? Like, no,
right.
I'm with you on that.
And the truth is, you know, there's not that many eyeballs on this, right? Like that's always been this idea of open source, is that many eyeballs make bugs shallow. But the truth is if you're not paying people to look for backdoors, if you're not paying people to look for flaws, the number of people who are just going to sit there in their spare time who are professionally trained is extremely small.
I saw presentations on exactly that topic at like KiwiCon 2. You know, I mean, this has been a right. problem we've known about for a long time. And the extent to which open source is just ignored is, you know, the first time you look at the numbers, it's a real eye-opener. Moving on to some international intrigue now. We've got a story from The Guardian here, which is, you know, I'm guessing is shaping up to be controversial. It alleges that Paul Manafort had secret talks with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in 2016. WikiLeaks has denied it, Paul Manafort has denied it, and Julian Assange is apparently already kicking off defamation proceedings. You look at the story and it does look pretty thin. It refers to sources and then at one point a source, and you just got to wonder if maybe, you know, someone might have been suckered in on this one. I it's just impossible to tell whether this is accurate reporting or not.
Yeah, it's hard to tell at this time. This is one of those stories that I don't even want to comment on because it should be incredibly easily provable. You know, that front door for that Ecuadorian embassy has to be just about the most surveilled front door in the Western world. It's already on an incredibly busy street, right, in London. And clearly, like, a significant portion of the apartments with a view of it have probably been rented out by foreign intelligence agencies, not to, say, MI5 plus the London Metropolitan Police. And so the... You know, there's got to be video of somebody who looks like Paul Manafort walking in that door, unless he was able to you know, be shot up the sewer pipes or something like that.
My favorite line in this is Manafort's 2016 visit to Assange lasted about 40 minutes, one source said, adding that the American was casually dressed when he exited the embassy, wearing sandy-colored chinos, a cardigan, and a light-colored shirt.
Yeah, it's those kinds of touches that I feel make The Guardian one of the greatest newspapers in the UK.
We need more of that, don't we?
Yeah, so I mean, we should find out pretty soon. This is also the kind of thing that I feel like this information is going to be in Mueller's lap right now. If you know, I feel like this is a bit of a spoiler. You know, I never want to read the subreddit on movies because I don't want to be spoiled on movies. I don't want to be spoiled for the Mueller indictment.
So even if it is true, you think The Guardian has done you a disservice.
Yeah, they really need to have a spoiler tag on top and the ability to filter this kind of stuff out, because when that Mueller report drops, I want to sit, print it, have my cup of coffee and really enjoy every single page of surprise.
No, I think for me, it's going to be a cognac, a smoking jacket, you know, and maybe a fancy vape.
Yeah, well, you could be a little more casual because it's not your democracy that they're talking about here. It's ours.
Now, look, moving on to something a little bit closer to your professional career here, Alex, the UK Parliament has used some sort of obscure power to seize a cache of documents pertaining to a lawsuit against Facebook. What the hell is going on here? Is it someone with a wig and a scepter came in and, you know, started chanting in ye olde English? What happened?
Yeah, so apparently I have no personal knowledge of this lawsuit or this company. But it looks like a company called 643 made a app called Pikinis, which is an application that back in the days when the Facebook API allowed you to delegate the ability for apps to see your friends' profiles the same way you do, that this was an app that would help you find bikini photos posted by your friends.
What a wonderful business. God.
Clearly an incredibly positive business that really is exactly the kind of thing that Facebook was hoping to power via API V1. That's sarcasm for those
attention reporters who are no doubt listening to this. That was sarcasm. Right. Alex didn't
mean that. Yes. Yeah. Yes, so when I'm deposed about this podcast later, please note that this was sarcasm. So anyway, 643 sued Facebook because Facebook made these changes in 2014 and 2015 to massively limit the API, effectively shutting off Cambridge Analytica type of issues where people who build apps against the API could take way too much data and sit on it. I think that was totally the right move. That happened before I joined Facebook, but clearly the API was way too loose and open before 2014, 2015. 643 sued, saying that this cut off their app. So they are effectively arguing that we should go back to the Cambridge Analytica age. And somehow, because they are anti-Facebook, they now have friends in the Digital Culture, Media, and Sport Committee of the UK Parliament, which is investigating Facebook. So we have this strange bedfellow situation where a Guardian reporter and the head of this committee who dislike Facebook are teaming up with this company that is absolutely a horrible violator of people's individual rights. The founder of this company found himself in the UK. He claims he was there for other meetings, but while he's in the UK, he meets with a reporter for The Guardian who has written a lot about this topic, in that she apparently tips off the parliamentary committee, and they send a man with a scepter. I don't think he actually had the scepter, but there are pictures of him with it in other circumstances, the sergeant of arms, to go knock on his hotel room to bring him to parliament. And after multiple back and forths, they sit there, threaten him with arrest, and force him to log into Dropbox and to pull down documents that were provided to his lawyers under seal in San Mateo Court, where this lawsuit is. And so to back up a little bit, the entire civil discovery mechanisms in the United States are based upon the idea that in a lawsuit, you can be forced to turn over your internal documents and emails, but the court will make sure that those documents and emails are only used for purposes of that lawsuit. And what the court does that by issuing a protective order. And I have personally been served these protective orders because as an expert witness, I have been given secrets from other sides of lawsuits than what I'm supporting. And you sign this protective order and you say, I will do everything to not leak this information. And the entire kind of system of how lawsuits work in the United States rests upon these protective orders actually working. In this case, the UK parliamentarians are claiming that their law overrides California law. I can't really speak to that, but it does seem very suspicious to me that this guy goes there, clearly
so
tells...
Hang on. Let me just cut you off there. It almost seems like if you wanted to leak a whole bunch of confidential Facebook stuff to the UK parliament, this might be a way to do it.
This might be the way to do it. And that's what I suspect happened here. It seems highly suspicious to me that he happens to go there for other business purposes and just happens to be receive this order. You know, the data was not in the UK. So that's one of the claims that the parliament is making, is that the data was in the UK. But it says in this filing by his lawyers, which the filing by the lawyers is wonderful to read because clearly it is his lawyers trying to disclaim any responsibility. Multiple times they say that their client did not contact them and ask for their advice because they are on the hook now with the judge in California for the violation of this protective order. They can be sanctioned, I think, up to being disbarred possibly. And so they wrote this huge document very, very quickly saying this had nothing to do with us. This was our client on his own. But the data was in Dropbox, which presumably those files were not actually in a UK data center.
And well, so you have to be fair, Alex, case. They were in the UK after he downloaded them from Dropbox.
Right. And so this is now this really interesting case. I mean, there's this a very interesting legal case. I think, you know, the UK probably does not want to go down this road because I don't think the UK wants to be added to the list of countries besides China and Vietnam that corporations have to send people with burner laptops to. If all of a sudden, like if you're involved in any kind of legal dispute and you end up in the UK, that they're going to end up forcing you to download stuff.
No, come on. To be fair, I mean, this is some pretty high stakes stuff. You know, I know that you would have a, you know, not exactly a neutral view having worked there for a long time, but this is high stakes stuff. I don't think this is a typical situation, right?
No, and Facebook has put itself in this place by not sending somebody, you know, they sent Richard Allen, who represents Facebook in the UK, but Mark Zuckerberg or Sheryl or somebody like that has not gone to this to give testimony. And I think that's actually a mistake. I think, you can't operate in all these countries and then thumb your nose at their duly elected representatives. But I do think it does smell like a setup by the 643 people to try to put themselves in a good position to force a settlement of basically saying we can use discovery in this lawsuit to dump information out to the parliament. An interesting twist today is then one of the parliamentarians talked about one of the emails in this big dump talking about a Russian IP downloading lots of information. And Facebook came back and said, yeah, that was just like one email from an engineer saying this looks suspicious. Upon investigation, that IP address belonged to Pinterest and was part of an official use of the API. So,
the phishing expedition on that cache has begun. But Alex, the whole point of you coming to do this is because you've been spending way too much time talking about Facebook stuff lately. So let's move on, shall we?
Yeah, please. New phone, who dis? I don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly, right? CyberScoop reports that Uber has been fined $1.17 million by UK and Dutch authorities. This is, of course, over the 2016 breach that they covered up by paying $100,000 to that guy. This is a very widely talked about breach. $1.17 million, I'm guessing Uber's response to that was to pull it out of their other pants.
Yes, well, you know, the other pants that have that wallet full of Saudi money, it turns out, so that they're doing okay. I mean, it seems like a reasonable fine. This was a situation in which Uber tried to kind of retroactively classify a breach as a
bounty,
bug bounty. Yeah, which I think Uber did not do the right thing. I am a little afraid of this whole situation starting to chip away against bug bounties, because the truth is every time somebody reports a bug via a bug bounty, you could argue that that is a unreported breach. And if we end up down the road where every single bug turns into a massive legal issue, then nobody is going to run bug bounties.
This person wasn't reporting through a program. They did download all of that data. Like, it wasn't a typical sort of bug bounty style interaction.
No, it wasn't a typical, and hopefully this is the end of it. I hope Uber pays the fine, accepts that they did the wrong thing. That does seem to be the position of the new CEO there. Let's just hope that we don't see future situations in which bug bounties are used as cover for real breaches, because it would be really sad if that was the implication given to regulators, that bug bounties are used to cover up breaches all the time, which is just not how you should look at them.
100% agree. Interesting situation here in the city of York. North Yorkshire police are apparently declining to press charges against someone who found a bug in some sort of city online database, online application. They found the bug, they reported it to them, and then the response from the council or the city was to call and report this to the police, and everyone was sort of getting a bit arm flappy over it. But the cops are like, no, this person did a public service. It's all good. Good news story, I guess.
Good news story. I've got to compliment the police of Old York here of making the right call. And this brings up a really interesting question, which is, what should responsible disclosure look like for government agencies? This really feels like the kind of decision that needs to be made on a nationwide basis. It would be great if the UK said, this is how you can report bugs to municipalities, because in the end, you don't want things like city councils that have been embarrassed by bugs turning around and going after researchers.
Yeah, I mean, I think this almost feels like it's happening more and more. So this is becoming the template, which is, okay, report it. And then the cops will usually use their discretion to say, no, that's not a thing. It's all good, right?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
USPS as well, the US Postal Service, had someone report a pretty serious bug to them. They did nothing. So after a year, this person reached out to Brian Krebs, who reported it to them, and of course they fixed it. This is a situation that's actually quite familiar to me as an InfoSec journalist. I've done this on many an occasion, sometimes with some pretty hilarious results. But again, it looks like a good outcome here.
Yeah, and I think, in the US, one of the things that I hope that we have, this new cybersecurity infrastructure security agency under DHS, it would be great to see them create the ability as a kind of a reporting location of last resort, especially for the federal government, right? If you find a USPS bug, there should be somebody in the government you can go to blow whistle other than Brian Krebs. Like, as great as Krebs is,
look, I think we need something like that for the private sector as well, because various certs have tried to do it in the past, and sometimes they've got, other work to do and they might not get around to it. For a time, there was one guy here working for the Australian Federal Police, and he became like the de facto clearinghouse. If you found a bug, you'd tell him, and he would ring up putting on his AFP hat and say, hey, I'm from the cybercrime division of the Australian Federal Police, and someone has very helpfully pointed this out, right? So that's how he would assist. He's not there anymore, unfortunately. So when people come to me now and they're like, how do I report X? Honestly, I just go,
Yeah. And I do think it needs to be government folks. And I think if you really want to make something like that work, you've got to have safe harbor for reporters. You're going to have legally that you are exempted from CFAA in the US and the equivalents around the world if you've done the right thing and you've gone to that reporting agency of last resort and you've taken them a bug responsibly.
Yeah, agree. Some interesting news around Rowhammer. We've thought that sort of ECC protections knocked it dead. Not so. But this is sort of early stage research by the looks of things.
Yeah, it looks very early. Taking a look at their preprint, looks like excellent research. It will be unfortunate if this holds up and it turns out that ECC really is vulnerable. That was, effectively, not a lot of people are obviously hosting cloud computing on non-ECC systems. And so for most enterprises, I think ECC was the backstop that made people not care so much about Rowhammer. If this turns out to be practical, which has not been demonstrated yet, then that is going to be a big deal for all the enterprise cloud computing companies.
Rowhammer seems to be the little technique that could, right? Because when it first came up, it was almost... I remember the first time something like this came up is Adam and I talked about a paper where people were typo squatting on domains that would sometimes get accidentally triggered by sort of random bit flips, right? So that was cool. And then we started seeing some research done on exploitation of this that was kind of like very much in the lab, not really that predictable. It progressed to some sort of reliable exploits against some platforms with a bunch of caveats. It just feels like it just keeps on trucking, right?
Yeah, and we've got to remember, ECC is built to prevent random bit flips from, cosmic rays and the like. It was never built as a security protection. So it is not shocking that ECC is not going to stand up to an intelligent adversary in the same way that you would have with, some kind of real cryptographic checks.
Yeah, and apparently DDR4, there's no word from these researchers about DDR4, which means probably it doesn't work against DDR4. So that's something.
Yeah, but never say never. That's what we're learning with
Never say never, right? That's the problem. Now, some news from the Washington Post has just broken. One of their reporters has got wind that an investigative reporter from Bloomberg is really trying to piece together the Supermicro story again independently, which suggests to me that Bloomberg are, in fact, look, they're publicly saying that they 100% stand by their bullshit Supermicro Chinese hardware backdoors story, but they have tasked someone who, by the looks of things, is quite a competent journalist to go around contacting every single source, type of source that you can think of when you'd want to put together a story like this. And, you know, they're not having much luck, if you're to believe this report, they're not having much luck verifying that original report. Reporting from Bloomberg.
So first, I think it's good that Bloomberg is doing that this themselves. I am sure there are other journalistic organizations that have people out there front running them a little bit. And so
I can tell you 100% right now there are. I've heard of some very major publications who are doing serious legwork on this.
Right, which is important. I mean, that Bloomberg story, the fact that it is falling apart, it could be really problematic for people who actually are concerned about supply chain attacks. Like this kind of chicken, saying that the sky is falling when it isn't.
Boy who cried wolf. That's the
boy
one
who called wolf. Yeah, sorry, not Chicken Little. what's my metaphor? You're right. Crying wolf on this could really hurt the ability for people to think about and to measure these risks in the supply chain in a reasonable way. And, you know, as somebody who is somewhat of an expert in corporate weasel language around security incidents, I can tell you that, like, this is the most definitive I've ever seen companies from Amazon to Apple deny that something is true. Like, they have given themselves absolutely no room. George Sethakopoulos at Apple, he's a friend of mine, he's their CSO, personally said this is not true and gave no wiggle room. If I was Bloomberg, I would take that very, very seriously.
Well, you know, it's really funny that you mentioned George there, because I've known George for quite a long time. I've known him since the early 2000s when he was at Microsoft. You know, George is a bit of a legend in InfoSec, really. He's the guy who was responsible for Windows XP Service Pack 2, which was the one that sort of closed off all services from the outside. They, you know, managed to convince management to break some backwards compatibility in Windows, which was just unthinkable at the time.
Right.
You know, George has been around the traps a while and was at one time a frequent visitor to Australia. So I've known him a long time. And after I recorded that interview with Joe Fitz on the Bloomberg stuff that blew up, I didn't publish it the day that it was ready, right? I slept on it. And the thing that really changed my trigger calculus on that is when I woke up and I saw the letter from Apple to Congress denying the story, and it had George's signature on the bottom. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm now much more confident that I can publish this.
Yeah, absolutely. Since we're name dropping, I think I've known George just as long, since I was there at Microsoft as a consultant, and actually have a story of being stuck in a limo with George and Dave Litchfield on a bridge that was drowned in the Seattle area due to floods. So
they're a good team, yes. Those two. Hi, guys, by the way, if you're listening.
Hi, guys.
We got a funny one here from ZDNet, which is about a Magecart group that, in order to sort of screw over a competing Magecart group, like, altered their code so that every credit card that their rivals intercepted would be incremented by one to sort of poison their database. That's kind of funny. I mean, it's not really a big story, but the reason I highlighted this one, the reason I wanted to talk about this one, is Magecart is everywhere right now. I mean, I'm getting emails from people sending me, like, breach notifications for small businesses, like local gyms, like online stores. And it's, you can tell by the way they've written about this breach, like, the credit card information was intercepted at the point of entry. Like, it's obviously Magecart. It's just amazing to me that it's taken this long for a group to figure out that you just drop your own PHP or whatever onto a site to do this.
Yeah, is there no honor among thieves? It's just very sad to see them turn on each other. Now, Magecart's a big deal, and I think we're going to continue to see this where people try to use the exact same code or the exact same attack vector. It is going to be not just who is first, which used to be the big deal, but who is trickier in making it difficult for their competitors to be economically competitive.
Yeah. Amazon exposure, that kind of isn't a big deal, although it's getting headlines, and I kind of don't get why. why. Oh, look, I mean, they're a big company, right? So that's why. But
right.
Amazon apparently exposed some users' email addresses. That's it. By the looks of their response, it seems to have been fairly contained. But they are being a little bit too tight-lipped on exactly what's happened here. And their email to users who were affected was terrible.
Yeah, I got that email. I am in the list of people who have been exposed. I think this is the meta issue here is that nobody knows what GDPR's data disclosure requirements are right now. There's a bunch of words that have been argued about in various working groups, but in the end, it is going to be years and years of litigation before we understand at what level of exposure do you have to disclose and whether a disclosure like this is good enough. Personally, I don't think this disclosure is good enough, but maybe it's just enough to get past the existing GDPR rules. I think this will be an interesting test case.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's a good point. This one, God. Google and Mozilla are apparently going to introduce functionality to their browsers that will allow them to edit files on disk. Now, of course, the advantage here is if you're using Google Docs or whatever, you want to save a file. You don't want to download it every time, right? That seems to be the idea. But, you know, everyone's kind of pointing out, like, this could maybe be abused.
Yeah, there's always these W3C working groups that are effectively, you could summarize as the working group on making JavaScript malware a reality, right? this is one of those. I'm shocked that Google, especially, who's done all of this work on sandboxing Chrome, would want to put themselves in a position where if they want to support this API, they have to pop a huge hole in one of their sandbox protections. Hopefully, if this happens, it happens in a way that is highly restricted, and that perhaps that even while it looks like you're writing to the file system, you're not writing to the real file system. You're writing to like a virtualized file system or something that is proxied or intermediated in some way. But I think this is not a smart move. And the in the story, one of the excuses is, well, you're going to have the pop-up box to choose what file you upload or you save to. The idea that you want to put this kind of responsibility back in users, I think is a real step back.
Yeah, and that's not how this works, right? And when you just said like some sort of proxy or intermediate thing, I'm like, well, that's where your bugs are going to be, right?
That's where your bugs are going to be. And if you want to have long-term file storage, you're really going to have to restrict by design where these browsers can write to. Otherwise, you're going to get rid of all the benefits you've gotten from having these operating system-based container systems and virtualization systems that can restrict browsers like Edge.
Now, the last thing we're going to speak about out of our news list this week, Alex, is Sean Gallagher over at Ars Technica is writing a multi-part series on the so-called Snowden legacy, and seems to have done a reasonable job of actually trying at least to write some balanced, like a balanced recap on the whole Snowden affair. I wanted to get your impressions on this because you found yourself working as a CISO in Silicon Valley very shortly after Snowden, dumped this cache of documents and were very much involved in the response to it. First of all, what did you think of Sean's write-up here? And second of all, what's your reflection on that time? It's been 5 years, 5.5 years. How do you look back on that time and him?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's been 5 years. So first off, I think Sean's great. I think he's done a really good job of trying to be balanced in his look back. And he is definitely one of my favorite writers in security right now. When I look back, I took over a CSO at Yahoo just a little bit after the Snowden disclosures. And so I had to take over the response of the company. And to start, it is absolutely true that there have been big improvements in security, especially at the big tech companies, based upon the Snowden disclosures. What those documents did is they turned what people knew was theoretically possible into ground concrete truth. Security is full of people who are always paranoid and always saying, oh, this bad thing could be happening. Supply chain attacks, there could be malware in my firmware. There could be Kaspersky could actually be a front for the FSB. People talk about that all the time. There's an infinite universe of possible bad things that could happen. When you're at a company and you're trying to make a decision of where you're going to put your resources and where you're going to put your time, it's not useful to know what's possible. It's useful to know what's actually going on. And so the fact that the Snowden documents said these are things that are going on, that there is widespread sniffing of public internet traffic, but also I think something that was overlooked by most people in a huge deal in Silicon Valley, what was called the muscular program that was disclosed, which is the tapping of the fiber optic backbone between tech companies, data centers, and POPs. That was a huge deal. And while everybody knew that was theoretically true, to have that in black and white was the only way you were going to get these companies to spend the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars necessary over years to encrypt all of that data.
And so, yeah, and I mean, you know, there were, even when Gmail had like a HTTPS front end, you know, the front end servers were still retrieving mail to present to the user in the clear from other data centers over fiber optic links, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think people, you know, the big consumer tech companies will run dozens of data centers, but hundreds and hundreds of points of presence. So a point of presence will be a collection of servers in a data center that is not controlled by that company. So usually in a local telco, that is where your HTTPS will be terminated. There will be servers there that intelligently look at the request and then route it to the right data center. And that routing will happen over dedicated bandwidth that is purchased from these transcontinental, you know, under ocean links. And that's a really important part of delivering service at speed to billions of people. But before the Snowden disclosures, those links were not encrypted because these companies were paying a ton of money to the Global Crossings, the Level 3s, the companies like that, expecting them to keep that data secure. And it turns out that all those companies had side deals, apparently, with the NSA to allow them to tap those fiber optic cables and perhaps even to rent them out space for the equipment necessary to then sniff that traffic. And so to make that clear actually drove a lot. And then clearly Snowden disclosures drove the adoption of HTTPS on the front end. So you can't say that there was no improvement from these disclosures. Clearly that happened. And you do have to wonder about the kind of risk management decisions inside of the government up to this point, because the US government clearly knew this was possible. They clearly knew that America's adversaries are probably doing the same thing. I would be shocked if the Chinese are not tapping all those fiber optic lines that land on Chinese soil, but then travel on to other countries in Asia. But decided that it was worth it to keep American systems insecure, to keep their intelligence gathering correct. So from that perspective, I think Snowden had a positive impact. But Sean is right to also, you know, we got to be a little bit critical, especially of those of us in tech, and I include myself in that, who thought that Snowden was just a hero, because some bad things came out of this. And I think, Sean talks about some of it, but of, you know, directly.
Well, I mean, I don't know what he was doing dropping docs on, you know, DSD, you know, now ASD operations in Indonesia. Like, you know, why?
Right. Like, there's a bunch of docs in there that, yeah. If you look at the documents that had really positive impact, you can really look at like 5 or 10 slide decks. And then There's hundreds of other ones that blew up really legitimate Western intelligence operations, or that did things like exposed bugs that are being planted in Syria in Cisco routers, or, you know, I expect in places like Russia or China, for which there is no civil liberties impact to Americans or America's allies, and for which there's, you know, real legitimate need. Like, as a taxpayer, I pay the NSA to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I got to ask too, like, one of my biggest problems with Snowden, and I agree with everything you just said. It's great having HTTPS everywhere. It's great. It really accelerated that trend, right? So I think that was
absolutely
overwhelmingly 100% a positive thing. So look,
they don't understand how hard it was to move to HTTPS. There's a lot of people kind of in the, you know, in the security industry who don't work at scale, who are like, oh, dude, you just go get a certificate and you turn it on.
Yeah, no.
The real problem like that we had at Yahoo is that Yahoo had all these websites that had third-party includes from this huge ecosystem of companies in the advertising and measurement ecosystem. And the only way you're going to get all of those companies to upgrade at once was from some kind of event like this. Otherwise, yeah. You know, if the Snowden disclosure didn't happen, even in 2018, we'd probably still be kind of chewing along.
Halfway there, right?
Yeah, a lot of these consumer sites would not be encrypted.
I got to ask though, what did you think of, because one thing where I look back on Snowden and he doesn't look so shiny in my view, is it seems pretty clear that a lot of his commentary around these documents was, you know, he was misinterpreting the stuff that he was leaking as best I can tell. What's your feeling on that?
No, and that's definitely true. You know, the first big stories was the Prism story. And if you look at the slide deck, you know, the meta commentary that came out of the reporters who wrote those stories that is based partially upon Snowden's quotes wrote the stories incorrectly and created this idea that the U.S. government had direct access to servers that could just push a button and go directly into the servers of Google, directly in the servers of Facebook, into Yahoo. And that's not true. Now, it is true that FAA 702 gives the government the ability to issue orders to American tech companies to turn over data, but that process is just like the process for normal warrants in the United States, in that it goes through lawyers, it goes through people whose job it is to approve and to verify that kind of stuff. Now, personally,
that PRISM story was absolutely terrible, but there were dozens of stories like that where certain journalists were, you know, really just taking source documents and just kind of making up the narrative, right, with no bearing on reality.
Yeah, and I think we're kind of dancing around certain people's names because we don't want to get called out by him on Twitter. Like, you never get in a Twitter war with somebody who tweets like every 19 seconds on average, right?
But I
do think that was a serious problem. There was both a couple problems. I think, you know, Snowden's comments around PRISM and some other things were not helpful and were not true and led people down the wrong path of understanding how these systems work. Like FAA 72, I do have a problem with the legal oversight of some of these orders. And I personally believe that we should not have classified appellate law in the United States. That's incompatible with democracy, but that is totally different than the initial story and the story that probably a lot of people still believe about the relationship between tech and DC, which has been a serious problem. When you look at what happened in 2016 with the Russian election, and I know you're trying to save me from talking about the same stuff that I have to talk about all the time.
Did you just call it the Russian election?
I'm sorry, the Russian interference in the U.S. election. Yes.
Interesting slip, but do
go on.
Yeah,
quite a slip. when you look at what happened in 2016, you could see that as a intelligence failure within the U.S. government, but also within the tech companies and between the government and the tech companies. And you can partially trace the inability for the U.S. government, other Western governments, and major U.S. tech companies to work together to some of the ideas that came out of the initial Snowden reporting. You can't look at that issue and not roll the clock back to
you can draw a straight line between those things. And I've spoken to people in government and I've spoken to people on the tech side as well. And that's absolutely a thing where they're kind of like, their hands are kind of tied, right? If they want to cooperate because there might be another leak and then that's going to hurt them.
Right. And these are, you know, the truth is there are significant disagreements between tech and government on some very important things like end-to-end encryption, of which I'm a strong supporter. But 90% of these issues demonstrate like a real shared mission, right? Nobody wants foreign governments to be able to mess with democracies. Nobody wants children to be exploited online. There is no real fight over these issues, but some of the challenges created by the way the Snowden disclosures were handled, which I think is not just on the journalists, but is on the U.S. government as well, because the response to the government during this time was absolutely horrible.
Well, you know, funny you mentioned, but, you know, NSA has public affairs people, right? Right now, right? They didn't. Yeah. You know, when their PR office opened was at the end of 2013, right? They did not have PR people when Snowden dropped docs, which is why they weren't putting out a counter narrative. I think the people responsible for NSA PR was like someone in a back room at the Pentagon somewhere, right? So it didn't, you know, they did absolutely nothing to try to correct this stuff. And look, here's another example of how Snowden's changed things is our SIGINT agencies in the Five Eyes nations these days are a lot more transparent. And I think that's in order to partially immunize themselves against maybe future events like this. But it's a good thing.
It is a good thing. And it's honestly a lesson the tech companies have to learn too, which is being transparent and open about the world's a dangerous place. We are working on these issues. We are trying to do our best is way better than creating a vacuum in which people can empty out their worst fears and perhaps their motivated reasoning, right? And so just like I think the NSA failed to come out and to be honest about what was going on and to say, you caught us. We were doing some things that perhaps we shouldn't have, but it's not as bad as what people are saying. They had an opportunity to do that in the first days, especially with like the Bart Gellemans, like the journalists who were going to the government for comment and getting no comment back. They really could have changed the narrative. And I think the tech companies, we've done the same thing, including my former former employer, of not filling the space with the truth. And therefore, people who really dislike these companies and are not really wedded to evidence-based claims are able to fill that space with what they think is the worst case.
TLDR, never create a vacuum that can be filled by Glenn Greenwald.
You said his name, not me. Please, all tweets should go to @riskybusiness.
Please address tweets to @riskybusiness. Hey, one final question, and this is really it because we've gone massively over time, which has been a lot of fun. One final question. Do you think Apple's decision to refuse to unlock the phone of the San Bernardino gunman, you know, keeping in mind it was an obsolete phone, pre-SEP, the FBI at that point, I think, were just asking to send the phone to them and retrieve the data back. Do you think that that was a defensible decision, or do you think that that was a mistake?
By the time it became a legal fight, I think it was right for Apple to fight it. And I, you know, am trying to be consistent here because I helped write the amicus brief by Facebook on behalf that supported Apple's decision. I think it would have been very dangerous to allow that precedent to be created. But you point out a really good point, which is in this specific situation, there seemed to be opportunities for Apple to take care of this issue in a way that did not actually decrease the security of its users. And so picking the fight in the first place on what could be in the long run a really losing battle might have been a tactical and a strategic mistake.
In other words, a strange hill to die on.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, Alex Stamos, thank you very much for being our guest news co-host this week. It's been a lot of fun, and I hope we can do it again sometime. Thanks again.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Patrick. And thank you for not making me do a Kiwi accent, because all my accents end up sounding like Sean Connery. So it's probably better for the listeners.
That was Alex Stamos there. Big thanks to him for that. And I do hope we can get Alex back on sometime next year, because that was a lot of fun. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now. Thinkst Canary is one of the security industry's best-loved companies, and that's because they make something that's cheap, easy to deploy, and very effective. Chris Gates is a fan of Canaries. Colin Mulliner has spoken about using Canary tokens to flag reverse engineering. Smart people use Thinkst stuff, both hardware, virtual, and just, you know, strings like tokens. Now, Thinkst offers hardware honeypots, of course, also virtual honeypots and Canary tokens, and they're free via canarytokens.org. And of course, they integrate those tokens into the monitoring console you get as a paying customer. So we thought this week we'd speak to one of those paying customers instead of a Thinkst staffer. Mike Ruth is a security engineer at Cruise Automation and did a talk at QCon all about automating the deployment of Canary tokens at scale. He joined me to talk about how that process works, what's effective and what's not, and here's what he had to say.
Yeah, well, so I guess I'll start and say that Canaries pay for themselves instantly from my perspective, from my view, right? Whether that's literal money or the time and effort invested into actually implementing them. If you do have an incident, they're going to be very valuable, right? Wherever they're located, even if they're not at scale. So it's sort of a double-edged sword though, right? Because if you get sort of overzealous with sort of putting canaries everywhere, that could become potentially problematic, right? Because you may get too many false positives if people are actually accessing the locations of these canaries, that because it's on a sort of day-to-day or sort of a common path, right? That could be problematic. However, if you do it intelligently and you start placing canaries in locations that should never be really accessed unless it's from sort of an attacker or an entity that shouldn't be looking there, then they can be extremely valuable.
So basically get them the hell out of the, you know, anywhere where a user might accidentally touch them. Like, I've heard a few people say that and it does make sense.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about some of your experience doing some of the fancier automated things with like Canary tokens. Like, what have you done there? Because that seemed to be, you know, a fairly substantial chunk of your talk at QCon.
Yeah, well, so generally speaking, right, when you start using Canary tokens, you can start putting them in a lot of cool places that you've typically automate, right? So if you take a look at automation tools, you can start using them in, you know, Terraform, CloudFormation, all these cloud tools, right? Where cloud is a place where you can't get hardware, physical things. But Canary tokens and virtual devices actually fit pretty well there, whether it's images that you're deploying or the strings, you know, in the form of tokens. So you can start looking at things like, okay, when you start deploying containers, right? Maybe maybe there are users that are deployed in those containers that can have canary tokens, or if you're creating manifests for Kubernetes or some sort of container orchestration, you can put things there. Or if you're automating the deployment of databases, right? So there are a lot of different use cases where if you need one for like every single VPC that you're deploying in your cloud or every single account that you're deploying, scalability becomes challenging. That's where automation comes in and becomes particularly valuable.
How much of a challenge is that? And at the other end, like what is the alerting hard to handle if you actually start putting them absolutely everywhere? Because those would be the two questions, I guess, that I'd have.
I think that getting a proper CI/CD pipeline in place for that automation is a challenge in and of itself, right? And I think organizations today and all over the world are challenged to do that, right? Once that's in place, it's just sort of a plugin that you get plugged into it, right? And that's the same for any sort of new deployment that you want to get introduced into your CI/CD pipeline. So I would say that, if you're an organization that's fairly well mature that already has this sort of CI/CD automation in place, getting Canaries automated is fairly easy if you spend some time sort of familiarizing yourself with how to create Canaries in the first place. To your second point, though, what happens when you get all these alerts now, right? You've got canaries everywhere. What does that look like from an alerting perspective? So harkening back to my sort of first point there, you may get overly fatigued with all of the alerts if you don't do so in sort of an intelligible manner. But that's really going to depend on where you put them and how frequently they're accessed.
Because that was the whole idea, right? With like Canary, was it's supposed to be very high quality signaling. And indeed, if you deploy a hardware Canary somewhere, people shouldn't touch it. Anyone touching that is bad, and it's an alert that you want to know about. Some of these Canary tokens, you start throwing them everywhere, you are going to actually have a bit of a feed there that you're going to need to filter, right?
Yep, absolutely. And so, I guess it comes down to, two gradients, right? If your alerting pipelines are pretty good at identifying false positives with / for you, maybe you can sort of reduce that noise some. On the other hand, maybe it's, a conversation or an architecture perspective where you need to like sort of curb back on where you're putting these canaries because you're getting too many false positives, and it happens to be that it's not as valuable as perhaps you wanted it to be.
So the next question becomes like, which types of canary tokens are you actually finding most valuable?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Which are the ones that give you the highest signal to noise? Because I'd imagine you would have seen some trends by now if this is something that you're doing.
Yeah, well, so it depends on your environment too, right? Like, I guess if we take a look at Think's line of tokens, they have a handful of different token types, but you don't necessarily need to be limited by one specific tool, right? If you need a specific type of token that gets created that a service doesn't offer you, you can go and create that. Now, of course, that's going to require you to have like alerting and all these other things that are in place to support that token type, or maybe it requires like an upstream change into, Think's Canary libraries. But I guess what I'm trying to say is like, if the token doesn't exist, you should create it first and foremost. But I would say that credentials are pretty great token types, right? So this is like AWS credentials is an easy win.
Yeah.
That's probably the top one.
Well, I mean, any type of credential really, because they shouldn't appear outside of that context. Like it just seems like a pretty big red flag, right?
Yeah, right. Well, but you also need to be careful. Like, part of the game is to sort of trick you're an attacker when it comes to credentials, right? They need to use them to be able to trigger, to trigger off the alert. So if it's obvious wherever these credentials or these tokens may be sitting, then maybe they don't use them, right? But these use cases may vary sort of wildly, right? Like, if you've got, if you've got like a Microsoft Word document that's sitting on an endpoint device that says like totally not a canary, like, that's probably not going to be too successful. But if you've got AWS credentials that are sitting in a specific user on a specific EC2 instance, maybe that'll be more valuable.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how many admins tend to keep passwords in text files on their desktop, though, right? So,
yeah.
How many pen testers do you know who've won that way, right? Quite a few.
Yeah. Yep, it's true. I had a joke during the QCon presentation where it's like, you know, so just store these wherever you store your credentials. Hopefully it's not on a post-it note next to your computer, but if it was, there are QR code Canary tokens. So you could probably put that right next to it and maybe that'd be helpful.
So I'm guessing, you know, by the sounds of things, you are using Thinxt's, you know, alerting, you're using their sort of Canary tokens platform and integrating it with all of your hardware honeypots and stuff as well. That's an all singing, all dancing sort of cloud Canary tokens platform. I'm gathering from the conversation that we've just had that you actually have asked them to do some custom token types for you. Is that right?
Well, so the folks over at Thinxt, they offer a handful of different variants, right? They've got Open Canary, which is a open source hardware or virtual Canary platform. So that's free. You can go and use that without sort of needing to interact with Thinxt at all. Same with canarytokens.org, right? Those are free as well. However, they do have a paid for service, and that's particularly valuable because they provide things like your alerting structure, your dashboards, your UIs, and also, you know, virtual images that are really easy to configure. So I have worked with sort of all of those different types. I don't think that I'd go so far as to say I've asked them to create their own token types, but certainly I have looked through their APIs and put upstream changes where there's sort of a difference in parity, right? Because you can take a look at their paid services and they may be missing a token type that you can find in their Canary org token free service, right? So it's really been back and forth on like, hey, you're missing this or that, even though you have it over here. So that's kind of the conversations that we've had.
Now, I've asked you what the best type of Canary token is. I got to ask now, what's the worst? Because I can imagine there would be a few that you push and you're like, oh God, what have I done?
Yeah, well, I think it probably depends on two thoughts, right? One is, you know, are there certain tokens that just aren't particularly valuable, right? And that might be because it's like a document type that isn't used much or things like this, right? And then the other might be actually, are there vulnerabilities or concerns in the way that certain things are implemented, right? With AWS credentials, the way that most of the alerting goes on in AWS, right, is through CloudTrail. So if you're monitoring CloudTrail for specific usage of credentials or ARNs, that's valuable for an alerting perspective. However, AWS has come out, and there was an article, I believe, by Rhino Security recently that have shown that if you use AWS credentials and you try and hit services that don't have support in CloudTrail, you can actually skirt around certain alerts. And that's been dangerous. And AWS has said, no, that's as designed. We're not going to change it. So there's some dangers actually from using certain token types because you may not actually get alerting where you may have actually needed it.
Yeah, I mean, that was, if I understand, it's the same thing that I read. It's really that they can more or less enumerate whether or not something is real or a canary.
Yeah. And the way that they do that is basically because of a lack of parity or lack of support from AWS's end with a specific service that they provide, as well as that service logs being read from CloudTrail. They don't end up in it.
So walk us through just one very typical implementation, automated implementation of a Canary token. Just walk us through one that's an easy win in this all singing, all dancing, you know, magical cloud Amazon world.
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, whether it's AWS or GCP or whatever the cloud is, you know, you need some sort of automation framework. So, you know, I gave sort of some high level, you know, pseudocode in the presentation that I gave on like, here's what a client might look like that needs to call an automation framework. And then I gave some sort of snippets on what that automation framework looks like. And it's basically just a bunch of Python calls sitting in a serverless function, right? Call it AWS, call it, you know, GCF, whatever it is. And so the idea here, right, might be you submit a PR to a repo, you know, you want to make a code change real quick. And then whatever that PR gets merged, it goes and kicks off through the CI/CD pipeline. But let's say instead of it going and just creating an image and deploying it through whatever, through Jenkins, through Terraform, whatever it is that you're using, it also goes and creates a token during this process, right? And that token, that may have a whole bunch of metadata that's associated with it, right? Whether it's the build that you're deploying or the use case with which you're trying to provide a token for, whatever it is. And then, right, you can go and take that token that's been created and pass it along through that sort of Git repo CI/CD step. And this may be valuable for a handful of things, right? One might be like, you want a token on every single pod that gets created for, you know, for this repo, right? So that's in your dev environment, that's in your staging environment, that's in your prod environment. That could be particularly helpful. Or maybe it's for onboarding, right? Maybe you want sort of endpoint devices to have a set of credentials or something like that. So with each new employee that gets that gets onboarded, you create a credential that's specific to their device. Those are pretty low hanging fruit that you can kind of get started with right away. And you could even take a look at sort of the pseudocode that I provided in my presentation to see sort of what that might look like.
All right. Well, Mike Ruth, thank you very much for joining us on the program to have a bit of a chat about actually really, you know, taking some of these things that for so many years were just security concepts and putting them into action in a sort of scaled way. It's been very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Patrick.
That was Mike Ruth from Cruise Automation there talking about automating the deployment of Canary tokens. Big thanks to him for that, and huge thanks to Thinxt for being the single biggest sponsor of the weekly Risky Business podcast. Big thanks to Thinxt Canary for that. You can check out their stuff at thinxt.com. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.